All right, Jim, thank you for being on the call. And tell us a little bit about what you've been working on in terms of smoke-free housing, and maybe I did send out the bio to everybody, so I think people are kind of familiar with the great work that you've been doing over the years.
Okay. Pete, thanks very much. It's always a pleasure. In terms of the work we've been doing on this, as you know, having been at the conference we had here in Ann Arbor some years ago, we've been working on the issue of smoke-free multi-unit housing since the early 2000s, and we put a particular focus on public housing and other affordable housing or subsidized housing, largely because, as everyone on the phone knows, smoking rates are higher among lower-income people, and we felt that that was a target audience we really wanted to get at. Right now, my estimate is that there are probably about 250 housing authorities around the country that have adopted smoke-free policies for some or all of their housing. Here in Michigan, we have currently 55, we call them housing commissions, but it's housing authorities. We have 55 housing commissions that have adopted smoke-free policies for some or all of their housing, and that includes four tribal housing authorities. And we've got a bunch more in the pipeline right now. So before this month is over, I would assume we're going to be close to 60 housing authorities that have adopted smoke-free policies. Those cover about 9,000 units of public housing. And I think that our estimate is that covers about 20,000 people. We also estimate that there are probably about 100,000 units of other affordable or subsidized housing that is covered by smoke-free policies here in Michigan. So we've got a very large number that have done this already. I think that in terms of the types of housing authorities or housing commissions that have adopted smoke-free policies here in Michigan, it's a total range, everything from smaller housing authorities that have just 20 units of maybe one building or a couple buildings, up to our largest housing commissions, Detroit, Lansing, and Grand Rapids. Detroit has got almost 2,600 units, and that includes about 400 to 500 units of scattered site housing, as well as your more traditional public housing buildings. Grand Rapids and Lansing both have about 900 units. So the range is quite wide. I think the important thing is that it has demonstrated that it doesn't matter what the size of the housing is, it doesn't matter what type of housing it is, and it doesn't matter whether it's Indian housing or regular public housing. We basically have had an opportunity to deal with virtually every one of those housing authorities, housing commissions that have adopted smoke-free policies, and I think that part of the reason for our success has been that we've developed a very good reputation with housing authorities as being knowledgeable, objective, easy to work with, and I think just a very high trust level between the housing authorities and us, and I think that's been one of the most crucial things. Our biggest referral source is actually housing authorities that we've already worked with. The word of mouth between them and their colleagues, and they're saying to their colleagues that they should give us a call and ask for assistance on going smoke-free. So in terms of the nation, I think that what we've seen is that some states have been particularly active on this issue, Michigan certainly, Maine, Minnesota, Oregon, and you folks in Colorado have been doing just an amazing job. I've been extremely impressed with what you all have done and have been pleased to be able to work with some of your folks, and not just Pete, but some of your housing authority folks. So, again, it's a real pleasure, and why don't I stop talking and open it up to questions?
But a couple more questions for you, and then we'll go open it up for more questions. A couple of years ago, we had a conference call with Linda LaFord and Andy Rodriguez and yourself, kind of the basics of how you do smoke-free housing and public housing. In the last year or so, are there a few things that you've discovered that maybe we haven't talked about before in terms of working with public housing authorities that maybe you'd like to share?
I think maybe the most significant thing that has changed in the last couple of years is that, as you know so well, HUD has spoken with many tongues on the subject of smoke-free housing. Earlier on, there was a lot of confusion coming from HUD officials where you were getting mixed messages. And I think that one of the real significant changes has been that in the last couple of years, HUD has, in fact, issued both a memoranda to public and Indian housing, but also to other HUD-subsidized housing, in which they've stated very clearly that they strongly encourage housing authorities to adopt smoke-free policies, and that they have said it's legal to do it, it makes good financial sense to do it. I think that's been very significant. And currently, we know that HUD officials are talking very seriously about whether they should mandate that all HUD-subsidized housing go smoke-free. Whether that'll happen or not, I don't know. I know I'm in almost weekly contact with HUD officials in D.C., in Washington, D.C., about this subject. We know also that there's some pushback coming from some members of Congress, and that may slow things down, but HUD is clearly very strongly in support of housing authorities adopting smoke-free policies, very strongly in favor of other HUD-subsidized property owners adopting smoke-free policies. I think that's very significant. But beyond that, I think it's really that in some states, at least, we're pretty much at critical mass in the sense that this is probably not a good time to talk about critical mass, but in some states, things are moving forward because so many of the housing authorities have adopted smoke-free policies, and other housing authorities in those states are saying that they should get on board. In other states, we're seeing not a lot happening so far. So there are probably 10 states in which there's real activity. Other states, minimal activity. So we've got a long way to go. I think that there are probably about 7.5% of the 3,300 housing authorities in the country that have adopted smoke-free policies. That's a long way from where we need to be, but I'm delighted again to see that Colorado is doing as much as guys are.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right about the HUD notice. I've been surveying housing authorities in Colorado in terms of just follow-up to see if they are in the process or have adopted those policies, and a few of them have indicated that the reason that they have started the process or have actually done it was because of the HUD notice. And then there's a few that said that they don't even remember getting the HUD notice or they didn't take it seriously. So the other thing just briefly discuss is that you will be here in June.
Right.
I believe there's three sessions for the Healthy Housing, National Healthy Housing meeting in Denver. So talk a little bit about what you'll be doing and who you'll be presenting with.
I'm delighted I'm going to be coming to Colorado again for this. And the session that I'll be doing is with Tina Pettengill from Maine. And Tina's somebody that has been on your conference calls quite recently and is an extraordinary person. And we'll be talking largely about what we're talking about today, and that is how to what seems to work on working with public housing and other HUD-subsidized housing, how to go about doing it, what the barriers have been, how to deal with those barriers, what brilliant insights do we have on how to do it. So it'll be a fun gig. One of the other things I should mention, Pete, that going back to your previous question about what may be a little bit different in the last couple of years, I think that the three issues that normally get dealt with when you're looking at smoke-free multi-unit housing are, number one, should we do it? Number two, how should we handle grandfathering of current residents who are smokers? And three, what do we do about outside on the grounds of the properties? And one of the things that I think we've seen is that earlier on, a lot the grandfathering issue, we found that a lot of property owners, including public housing, were adopting smoke-free policies, but were grandfathering current residents who were smokers for as long as they lived in their unit. We're seeing that change pretty dramatically now. It still happens that kind of grandfathering goes on, but more and more we're seeing housing authorities and other multi-unit property owners adopting smoke-free policies and setting a finite date when it applies to everyone. It's becoming more and more rare to have current residents who are smokers grandfathered for as long as they live in those units. And I think that's happening because property owners, including housing authorities, are recognizing that if they see that secondhand smoke is an issue, then they should deal with it and bite the bullet, address the issue. And they're seeing that very few folks move out of housing because of a smoke-free policy. So they're not losing residents when they adopt the policy. I think the other thing that we're seeing is that earlier on, a lot of the smoke-free policies applied only to the elderly or elderly disabled housing, not so much to family housing, and it was quite rare to see the smoke-free policies apply to scattered site housing, which might be single-family homes, it might be duplexes or quads, that kind of thing. We're now seeing more and more housing authorities and other affordable housing owners adopting the policies for all of their housing, including their scattered site housing, including their single-family homes. And I think that that's happening for two reasons. One, they're, again, seeing that it's easy to do this and people follow the policy, the smoke-free policies, but also they're recognizing that the health issues are there and the maintenance cost issues are there. And I think that probably the primary catalyst for a lot of housing authorities adopting the smoke-free policies is not the health issue, it's the maintenance cost issue. The rehabbing apartments where there have been smokers, the cost being so much greater than rehabbing a unit where there have not been smokers. So, again, that's just to what's changed in the last couple of years. I think those are a few of the things that have changed.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and open up the call to any questions you may have. Please announce your name and who you're with.
This is John Young, Denver Public Health. Jim, I have a question. You had mentioned that there's been a pushback from Congress. Can you tell us a little more about that? Like, why is there a pushback?
This is sort of grapevine kind of information, okay? But I've heard from a couple of sources that there are some members of Congress who have gotten wind that HUD might be considering mandating that all public housing or all HUD-subsidized housing would have to go smoke-free, and they've begun to ask some questions, some probing questions about what's going on. When HUD Secretary Sean Donovan went before Congress, I think it was last week, to testify, we had expected that that might be raised. It was not raised at the hearing, which is a good sign, but we think that there may be some members of Congress who would not be supportive of this interpretation, and so we're sort of holding our breath right now about whether there will be a problem. The thing that is being considered by HUD is whether they should do an updated interpretation of what safe and sanitary housing means. And as you all know, HUD statutes say that HUD housing should be safe and sanitary. And what has been urged upon HUD, and which considering now, is to interpret safe housing to include physically safe housing in terms of secondhand smoke. I think that it's totally logical to interpret it that way, but when it has not been interpreted that way in the past, it becomes a significant change in interpretation. So the question had been posed earlier on with HUD officials of could they go ahead and mandate smoke-free housing simply by reinterpreting the statute, or whether they should wait for Congress to explicitly address this issue. And I think it's that when they're now considering how to interpret safe and sanitary housing, I think there are some members of Congress who might be of the viewpoint that nothing should be done until Congress explicitly acts on it. So we'll see. This is something that's been in the works has been discussed for a couple of years now. So far, nothing has explicitly been done other than the HUD notices that strongly encourage housing authorities and other HUD-subsidized housing to adopt smoke-free policies. Whether they'll take the next step of mandating it without further congressional action, I think, remains to be seen. But at least we know that some folks on Capitol Hill are aware that it's being discussed, and there are some folks there, we think, that would not necessarily agree with that interpretation.
Jim, this is Jill from the Department of Health. We've met before. I don't know, I so appreciate your work and leadership for us. The question I have is, is that a precedent where Congress defines what's safe for HUD? I mean, that seems kind of a stretch that Congress would be the authority of what constitutes safe and decent.
Congress, as you know, plays both an active role in terms of enacting laws, but they also have an oversight responsibility, and it's not uncommon for Congress to hold hearings in which they question officials of the executive branch on any number of topics, and as a way of gaining an insight as to what's going on in implementation of those laws. And certainly in those hearings, it's quite common for representatives and senators to express their own views of how laws should be interpreted, what was intended. So
like defining radon levels or, you know, other types of contaminants, they would get involved with that as well?
Well, they certainly could. I mean,
okay.
Just take a look at what goes on with global warming.
Well, that's true. I thought of that as soon as I asked that question.
Yes, I thought you.
Yeah. But, oh yeah, we don't, it's not necessarily the science.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Jim, this is Karen and from Delta County. And sorry if I missed this part or not, but if you talk a little bit more about grandfathering and what might be sort of the acceptable range or what you're, you know, kind of seeing in terms of, you know, months and a defined period.
Right. Yeah. Right now, what we see is that you've got the whole range of everything from, I guess, the two major flavors that come up in terms of grandfathering, the approaches at least, are one, to simply pick a finite date and say that as of that date, all residents will have to abide by the smoke-free policy. For example, passing a policy right now and saying that as of July 1st, all current residents, all new residents, all staff, all guests will have to abide by the smoke-free policy. The alternative approach being to say that this is, what, March, we passed the policy today, we put it in effect on April 1st for all new residents, all staff, all guests, and all current residents who are not smokers, but then we grandfather in current residents who are smokers and put the policy in effect for them on July 1st, January 1st, what have you. Those are the two major approaches. What I'm seeing at least, is that more and more the grandfathering period is 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. Not a lot of grandfathering that goes beyond that unless the policy says that their grandfather, the current smokers are grandfathered for as long as they live there. I'm seeing much more the 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. And I think the reason for that is twofold. One, folks are seeing that it's not that difficult to implement the policy. And secondly, they're saying the reasons for our doing this are reasonable. They make sense. And if we're going to say that secondhand smoke is dangerous, if we're going to say that the maintenance costs are way out of line with what they should be when we allow smoking in there, that if those two things are the case, then why are we fooling around and grandfathering folks for as long as they live there? We're not getting we're not dealing with the issue if we do that. The one other thing I'm seeing at least, is that a number of places that have adopted smoke-free policies in the past where they have grandfathered current residents who are smokers for as long as they live there, housing authorities are going back and revisiting that. Here in Michigan, we've seen, I think, two or three or four, I'm forgetting now, housing commissions going back, revisiting that and changing the policy and saying, okay, we grandfathered you for as long as you live here. We're going to change that now, and we're going to set a finite date, and that finite date is usually 3 months or 12 months out.
Yes, Pete, one other thing that I find also is that in terms of housing authorities, that they will want to grandfather them towards the when their leases come due, and because those leases usually, every month it's different, so if they want to start doing the policy 1 year from today, they might, wait a total year before the policy becomes effective for everybody to give people when their leases come due.
Yeah, we had seen that also, Pete, and that initially a few housing authorities here had done that where they said that they would do it on lease renewal, and part of that was due to some HUD letters that had suggested that as a possible way of doing it. What I've found is that very few housing authorities more recently have used the approach of lease renewal, largely because it complicates their lives. As you said, that means that for a year you've got a rolling implementation, and just for implementation purposes and enforcement purposes, it's easier to just have a set date when it goes in effect for everyone. Otherwise, where you've got every month another one, two, three, or how many folks having their lease up for renewal, it's real hard to handle the enforcement, because it's hard to keep track of which unit has got a smoker in it and who's grandfathered, which unit doesn't have it. So I'm seeing less and less of the policies going in effect on lease renewal, unless that lease renewal is a finite date. But where it's whatever month the person moved in is their lease renewal date, it just gets too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, this is John, again, from Denver Public Health. Would you talk a little bit about enforcement?
Right. Generally speaking, enforcement has not been a real issue. And we thought that it would be, or it might be. In fact, do people violate the smoke-free policies? Yes, they do. Do they do it in very high numbers? It seems that they do not. So most of the housing authority directors that I've spoken to have said that they really don't have any more problem enforcing this rule than they do other rules that they have. Have there been evictions because of violation, where the primary reason for the eviction is violation of the smoking policy? Yes, there have been. Have they been very many? No, not many at all. Here in Michigan, for example, we've got about 9,000 units that are now covered, and evictions where the primary reason for the eviction was violation of the smoking policy, I would guess that less than 10. So if it's, you know, 10 evictions, 9,000 units, that's a pretty good percentage. But certainly there are violations. Usually the violation are folks who violate other rules as well. But there are some folks who this is the major reason. And whether it's because of the addictiveness of smoking or whether it's that they just don't like the policy and they're going to flaunt it, I don't know. But certainly there have been evictions, but again, they have not been very frequent, and the courts have certainly upheld the evictions when they've taken place. Most housing authority directors try very hard to help residents not be evicted for this reason, but if the person is really flaunting the policy, the housing authority really has no choice. And I think that most directors feel that if they don't enforce the policy forcefully, then the policy is not going to exist and they're going to have lots of problems. So they're taking the same position with this as they would with any other lease violation. Any other questions?
Yes, this is Karen again. What do you see in terms of the designated smoking areas, that people are adhering to those areas, or do you are still seeing that, you know, they're wandering off on the sidewalks and maybe closer to the building, or, you know, have they been pretty, you know, successful at staying in those areas?
I think, generally speaking, yes, folks have been abiding by the outdoor designated smoking area rules, just as well as the indoor ones. And again, here there are a wide range of ways housing authorities and other property owners have dealt with this. Some have said have not even addressed the issue. We always recommend that they definitely address the issue one way or another. Some have said the range has gone from not addressing at all to saying no smoking anywhere on the grounds. Others have said you have to be X number of feet away from the building. Others have said we're going to define and specify a specific area where smoking can be done. And usually if it's that way, people put a picnic table out there, some benches, some chairs. Some have actually built gazebos. A few places have literally laid a cement slab and put a bus stop type structure there. Usually, if there is a designated smoking area, they also put some kind of cigarette butt container so that folks don't litter. And I think where they have done that and have said cigarette butts are litter, it's your responsibility, smoker, to put it in the container, not throw it on the ground. We don't want our maintenance staff having to waste their time picking up your cigarette butts. People have pretty much adhered to that. The issues that sometimes come up are if you build a gazebo, the non-smokers want the gazebo too. So you might as well build two of them. I think, yeah, people generally have been following that. And some housing, there's just no outside area that makes logical sense to have the smoking area, so the housing authority has simply said there's nowhere on grounds that you can smoke. Others have said the same thing, but they've done it for aesthetic reasons, and that is they don't want prospective residents seeing a cadre of smokers standing outside the building as their first introduction to the housing. So, but again, my philosophy is if housing authority or other owner wants to designate a smoking area outside, that's fine. Do what they think works best for them. And if you've got elderly residents who have been smoking for 60 years and have a really tough time quitting, then having an outdoor area where they can go even though it may be 10 degrees outside, is fair enough. But we certainly just say these are the options that we've seen. This is what you might try. These are the things you ought to consider, and then go for it.
Yeah, and I think, too, the other thing that's important is good signage and good communication as to exactly where the designated areas are, especially at the start of the policy. You know, it's just like the no smoking signs that if people know where they are, then, if people are violating the policy, other people can just say, don't you see that the designated area is over there? It helps with the enforcement.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the nice things on these smoke-free policies is that the non-smoking residents are probably the best enforcers of the policy because they're telling fellow residents that you can't smoke in your unit. They're saying, as you were just saying, Pete, they're the ones who are pointing out that's the designated smoking area. You need to do it over there. So management doesn't have to do as much enforcement as we might have thought they'd have to.
Jim, this is Ivy in Grand Junction. In regards to the entrances to buildings, that's one of the primary complaint areas for our residents. And are you finding that 15 feet is a good enough distance from main entrances to buildings, or should it be 25? Do you have a recommendation on that?
My feeling is that this is something where it really depends totally on the particular building. And my recommendation is always take a look at your building, your grounds, how it's set up, and decide where you think a good designated area would be. In some places, 15 feet may work just fine because wind blows in a pretty consistently in a certain direction, so that's far enough away. And the way the building is structured, that works. Other places, 15 feet might not be very good at all. Really depends on the building. I always recommend that the housing authority director and staff go outside, take a look at the building, the grounds, and then figure out what would happen in terms of where would the smoke blow, and look at where is the logical place to have that smoking area. I think you really need to individualize it. The properties are so different.
Yeah. That's actually what we are doing. One of our properties has 17 buildings, so we definitely are. We're writing separate policies for the two buildings to make sure that they meet the needs of the building, and we're trying to make sure that people don't have to walk through smoke,
right?
No matter where they're going. So those are kind of our two primary criteria that we're looking at right now.
Yeah, and the model policy that we've developed does not usually say specifics about the designated smoking area other than to say there will be no smoking allowed outside except in designated smoking areas, if any. And then that allows the housing authority director and staff to make a determination of where those designated areas will be, if there'll be any of them. And it also means that they don't have to keep on going back to the housing authority board to change the policy just to change where the designated areas are.
Definitely. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a scientific number, Jim Repace has a paper he put together a few years ago that recommends no less than 20 feet. Any other questions for Jim?
This is John again. I've got two questions. One is, do we have a copy of that model policy, and if we don't, can we get one? And then the second question is, from concept to actual policy, on the average, how long has it taken there in Michigan?
On your first question, I don't know if you do or not, but I'll forward the policies to Pete, and then he can get them out to folks. Basically, we've got two different ones that are pretty much mirror images of each other. One, and they go with the two different options I mentioned of either a finite date or one where you have a finite date for everyone except current residents who are smokers, and then a finite date later for them. I'll forward that to Pete, and he can get it out to you. In terms of how long does it take for, I think your question was, how long does it take from initiation to putting into effect? Is that?
Yeah, from concept of, well, we're thinking about it, to actual policy. How long generally, on average, has that taken?
I don't even think we have an average. We've had a few cases where it's gone from initiation to implementation of 2 months, just 2 to 3 months. And it's usually where the housing authority director and board have talked about it over the years, or maybe haven't even talked about it, but the director comes back from a meeting where she or he is heard the discussion about this, takes it up with the board chair, and they decide, yeah, it's a good idea. I get a call, give them the model policy, and they do 30 days notice, and they put it in effect. Others, we have had some that have dragged out for 2 to 3 years, literally, where the board has an interest in it, then does a resident survey, then decides to do another resident survey, then all of a sudden they need to re-carpet all the buildings they've got. So all of a sudden, carpeting of buildings takes precedence over everything, and they put everything else on the back burner. Nothing happens. Other times, board member is opposed to it, and the board wants to just hold back and not move forward, so they wait until that board member goes off the board. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. So it can go relatively quickly. If I had to pick an average, I'd say, 3 to 6 months, but it's so idiosyncratic. Really depends on the director, depends on the board members, and depends on what else is going on in their life at that time. So we basically take the view that we've got to have at least 10 in the pipeline at any given time. Because some of those are going to drag, and others are not going to drag. Some are going to move very quickly. I take the view that running public housing is not easy. Running any kind of multi-unit housing is not easy. There are lots of things that come up, and I need to be very flexible and provide advice, provide assistance, provide a nudge here and there. But I also need to recognize that there are other factors that are going to come into play for these folks, and pushing them too hard when they have other things that they know they have to get done is probably going to be counterproductive.
Thank you, Jim.
I wanted to also say that from working with the housing authorities here in Colorado, that it's usually taken anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half, and I would say the average is probably a year. Also, on our website, mysmokefreehousing.org, in the public housing section, we do have Jim's policy. It's called No Smoking Policy Model. But we also have the policies of the Fort Collins Housing Authority, the Boulder Housing Partners, and the Boulder County Housing Authority policy as well, because since that one's from Michigan, a lot of times people from Colorado prefer to look at what other people have done in Colorado, although the ones that have been done in Colorado are pretty much copied from the Michigan model. So those are on our website if you're looking for them. Are there other questions from other people?
Pete, this is Jill.
Go.
And I also want to make sure everybody knows that one of the things that TARP is working on is model policy language for all of our various policy provisions, and I think they're pretty close to completion of a model policy for smoke-free housing. And if I'm not, I think I'm remembering correctly that one of the upcoming calls is going to be about that model policy. Is that what you understand, Pete?
In April, yes.
Yeah, okay. And the other question I have for Jim is about some of our housing authorities prefer kind of a phase-in model. Are you familiar with that? I mean, you know, where you phase in certain buildings as opposed to going system-wide at first. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's earlier on being, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was quite common for housing authorities to take just some of their buildings smoke-free and not others. Usually they were taking their elderly housing or their elderly disabled housing smoke-free sooner than they did their family housing, largely because the percentage of smokers was higher usually in the family housing than it was in the elderly housing for sure. With elderly disabled housing, depending upon the percentage of folks who are disabled, where you usually have higher smoking rates. excuse me. We found that now we're seeing more and more. Excuse me, I need to get a drink here. We're seeing less and less of the phasing, but we still see it happening more and more. What we're seeing is that housing authorities are saying, if we're going to do this, let's do it for all of our housing, family as well as elderly and disabled housing. But certainly it's not that uncommon to see them taking some buildings smoke-free now, waiting on others. But I think the trend is more and more to doing all of it. An example of that is that here in Michigan, at least, Detroit Housing, which has got, as I said, about 2,600 units, and Lansing, which has got about 900 units, they decided that they considered phasing, and then they simply said, why are we phasing? It doesn't matter how many buildings we've got, the same policy, and we're simply saying as of X date, everyone has to stop smoking inside. And they decided it wasn't any more difficult to put that policy in place for their family housing than it was for any of their other housing. So we're seeing less and less of the phasing, but we still see it happening sometimes. The point I think we've been making is that while there may be some difference in the number of or the percentage of smokers in family housing versus elderly or elderly disabled, it's not that significant usually. I usually recommend that they take a look at each building and do a resident survey or have their manager try and guesstimate what units have got smokers and what units don't, and figure out if they've got some housing that's really an anomaly, it's got like 40% of residents that are smokers, then, and they've got some other buildings that have much lower percentages, I might suggest that, yeah, phase it in. Take those other buildings smoke-free totally as of a finite date, and maybe on that building that's got a high percentage of smokers, maybe temporarily grandfather the current residents who are smokers for either a finite period or for as long as they live there, but with the statement that this policy is going to be revisited next year, and we'll see about whether to change it, but make sure that anyone coming in is going to have to abide by the no-smoking policy and thereby reduce the, by attrition, reduce the percentage of smokers. And again, I always worry about enforcement, and if you've got a real high percentage of smokers, it may be very difficult to enforce a finite date, and I then ask the housing authority to think about and consider whether they can pull it off or not. But generally speaking, we're still saying pick a finite date, no more than 12 months out, and put it in effect, and then enforce it.
Yeah, I certainly have found that too. It's, and you've got to And I always, you know, recognize the fact that housing authorities have a lot of bureaucracies that they have to deal with, and they've got a lot on their plate, and that no smoking policies has, you know, not always been their top priority. And so even if they start with, you know, just, you know, a few buildings, that's great, because, you know, we know from some of the studies that were done in Oregon that once people start implementing no smoking policies in one building, they often move on to other buildings. So,
and we've certainly had that experience here where the first housing authority that went smoke-free here in Michigan was Cadillac, and that was in July of 2005, I believe. Yeah, 2005. And they did it only for their elderly housing. This past year, 2010, on that elderly building, they grandfathered current residents who were smokers for as long as they lived in the unit. Interestingly, last year, they revisited the policy and adopted a smoke-free policy for their family housing, which they had not done earlier, and they set a finite date for when that went into effect. And then early this year, they revisited that elderly housing policy and decided to set a finite date 90 days out where it was in effect for everyone. So they revisited that grandfathering as long as folks lived there and said, enough is enough. 90 days from now, it's in effect for everyone. So they had revisited the family housing thing. They'd also revisited the grandfathering issue. And I've seen that happen on a number of occasions here in Michigan with housing commissions who had not taken all of their housing smoke-free when they first did it and now are going back and saying, okay, it worked fine. There's a good reason for doing it. We're going to do it for everything.
Are there any other questions from anybody else? Doesn't sound like it. All right, doesn't sound like anybody else has any other questions. I want to thank you again for your time, Jim, and I hope we can get together when you come out here in June. We'll try to work something out, and at least worst comes to worst, maybe we can go to dinner.
Sounds good to me. Thanks very much, and I appreciate being able to do this. It's always a pleasure, and I look forward to being out there in June.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.